So I consider, for instance, this chair as being being occupied in trust. And
there's a lot of difference, right, between the role of the teacher in a group situation and trying to constellate small subsets.
Yes.
Having been involved in group work many, many years.
Yes.
When I was a younger man.
Yes.
It's a very rare thing that a group will constellate by itself. There is no such thing as a leaderless group. It doesn't work.
Well, that's right. There's not a leaderless group, and therefore the packets of humanity here are not really groups. That is to say, they do not occur in a structure as nodules in a structural plan. That's what a group is. But what are they then? It's a different form from that. The best way to speak of it is that these different committees of people are phases in a process rather than nodes in a structure. If you portion out leadership, you already set up a priori the structure. It's already there. And the people become constituents of a node. Whereas I'm emphasizing that that is not what is happening here. Notice that this assignment is not happening in other sections. It's happening in the section on magic, the section on psychic energy. What's peculiar about psychic energy is that it's interpersonal. If there's any distinguishing mark of psychic energy, it's interpersonal, amazingly. Psi energy is interpersonal. Just singling out telepathy is quite legitimate and quite real. It is real magic, and is real psychic energy, and really does occur in this thing. Those capacities are latent in people and are stimulated by this kind of activity. The closest thing, I guess, in a sociological level is that of a working family and a broken family. A broken family have come to size themselves up in terms of their place in a social structure that they're not measuring up to. And whose fault is it that that's happening? Whereas like a working family occurs in the nature of life, and their guide is not the social mores, but the wholesomeness of the natural workings of a situation. So they are not nodes in a structure, but this is a phase in the life process. It's a different way comporting is the term, different way of comporting towards the situation. No matter what happens in a life process, we're together. Because the outlook is that, well, this is what's happening. But in the other, any change has to be calibrated and measured against the structural expectation. And very frequently the judgment is we're not going to be able to measure up. We're not, in our configuration, going to be able to work. So let's break it. Let's dissolve it. Let's get out of it, and something like that. Whereas in a life situation, it's, well, whatever comes up, good or bad, that's what comes up. And we'll live it together. It's like that, that kind of an emphasis. So this is a life training in that magic. And notice that the theme constantly here at this particular juncture, the theme is that life and consciousness braid together and are the real together. Whereas if you begin to distinguish between the two of them, make them oppositions, they will not only be oppositions, but work in an apposite way. And you will increase your consciousness, sure, but life will become more and more subconscious to you, more and more of a mystery. And this whole bringing of the two together, the bringing of life and consciousness together, is what the art of person making is all about. And of course, the great example that we're using here is expressed in the resolving technique of Basho. Basho's resolving technique of writing the haiku is the perfect bringing together, the perfect synthesis of a thesis and its antitheticality back together into a synthesis. And the moment that stimulates the haiku, the desire to write the haiku, that's the thesis. And the writing of the haiku, the words, the images that come out and that you might puzzle over something, that's the antithetical movement towards definition. And when it's done, the reading of the haiku for the moment is the synthesis. So in his exquisite genius, Matsuo Basho found a way to put this most arcane of all processes into a nutshell. And no one had ever seen it quite that way before. No one had ever been able to refine it to its essential. This is the Japanese genius, to refine it to its essential qualities and deliver it whole in its essentiality. And you can decorate it in any way that you want. But this is it. And so the haiku is literally the bringing together of the 16 moments of thought, the 8 that can be specified and the 8 that cannot but occur together. But then there's one more, which is the gestalt of the whole. And so the 17 syllables of a haiku are really arcanely exact in terms of the Asian tradition. Basho was a consummate summation of the genius of Asia, which was not only Zen is a wedding of Taoism and Buddhism together. But the conscious part of Zen is Taoist, and the life part is Buddhist. It would not have been possible for Basho had there not have been this long great tradition. But then, because there's this long great tradition, doesn't ensure that there is a Basho. Someone has to really do that, and he did that about 300 years ago. And when we consciously do what he did, when we write haiku with the kind of background that you have here, that experience, that technique and that experience, that life awareness and that conscious insight become empowered to an extraordinary extent. I think one of the best examples of crossing that threshold that anyone could ever have heard about is the one that happened to Walter, who couldn't write a haiku, This was in the process a couple of years ago. Couldn't. It was a barrier. and he's woodworking outside one day, and he's brushing off his wood, the blossoms falling on, and suddenly he caught himself. The blossoms falling on the wood grain that he's trying to shape. The rain of spring, and there was the haiku, and it was not only breaking through the threshold, but it resolved the entire psychic energy of that whole threshold, which, when you put your whole self into it, is an ebullience of insight that echoes through your entire being. I mean, what can you say? There it is. So, in a way, the only thing I can do in this chair is to stir the pot with enough richness in there. Make sure that the vegetables are in there and that the fire is on, but that at some juncture and point you get to tasting that stew. And that's for you. That's your nutrition. That belongs to you. Should not be usurped by anyone. One of the few shoulds that you can really trust. Don't steal someone else's life moment. Contribute to it. In a religious sense, that's the Holy Spirit in that. Well, let's go to the secret of the golden flower for just a moment and see. Let's use this as an example. Let's hear from Sina and Dolores, and then we'll hear, how long is the tape by Robert?
Well, they go in the other sequence. The tape would be first, it's about 8 minutes.
All right.
And then Dolores has the next section, and I have the last.
Well, let's do it that way. Okay.
I
got it just backwards, did I?
I guess I'll have to use mine to play this.
When I first read Jung's commentary, I was very confused by the lack of direct quotes from the original text. This made me suspect of what he was actually talking about. When I found a quote, I researched it. Jung took the second line of a comparison that illustrated a sexual philosophy out of context. He redefined it in his own non-sexual way and commented on his redefinition. When I mentioned this to a number of people about what Jung had done, I was not believed. They were upset by what I'd said and did not believe that Jung would do such a thing. They didn't believe he would take a quote out of context and comment on it. Because the original two-line statement in the translation is quite cryptic and needs extensive defining, and then this compared to Jung's comment is like two rabbis getting together. You have at least three opinions. I am told that scholars do this all the time, and that this is not really a point in question. So my insight into Jung will be working with the translation of The Secret of the Golden Flower and Jung's commentary on it. The translation of the text, The Secret of the Golden Flower, speaks of many things. The way the ancients really obtained long life is told in theory, and the actual technique is not described. The ancient techniques for men of long life, vitality, and health are available. Companion techniques for women that preserve their energy, create long life, and prolong their beauty are also available for those who are interested. These have just been published in the recent years. I have only heard gossip about Jung's personal philosophy and sexuality. I believe a reading from the translation, and then Jung's comments about instinctive demands, finishing with a half a paragraph from the conclusion, will add some insights into Jung. I will leave Roger to clean up any mess I make. To quote from the text, the part A Magic Spell for the Far Journey, page 62. One single turning means one heavenly cycle. What Master Chu has called a small heavenly cycle. If one does not wait to use the energy until it has been collected sufficiently, it is then too tender and weak, and the elixir is not formed. If the energy is there and not used, then it becomes too old and rigid, and then, too, the elixir of life will hardly be produced. When it is neither too old nor too tender, then is the right time to use it purposefully. This is what the Buddha meant when he says, the phenomena flows into emptiness. This is the sublimation of the seed into energy. If the pupil does not understand this principle and lets the energy flow out directly, then the energy changes into seed. This is what is meant when it is said, emptiness flows into phenomena. To quote further, an ancient adept said, formerly every school knew this jewel, only fools did not know it wholly. If we reflect on this, we see that the ancients really attained long life by the help of the seed energy present in their own bodies. They did not lengthen their years by swallowing this or that sort of elixir. To quote further, the accumulated seed is transformed into energy, and the energy, when there is enough of it, makes the creatively strong body, making thoughts and energy harmonize with one another. He can complete the elixir within the 100 days. Now to move to the commentary by C.G. Jung. We should do well to confess at once that, fundamentally speaking, we do not understand the complete detachment from the world of a text like this. Indeed, that we do not want to understand it. Have we perhaps an inkling that a mental attitude which can direct the glance inward to this extent can bring about such detachment only because these people have so completely fulfilled the instinctive demands of their natures, that little or nothing prevents them from viewing the invisible essence of the world? Can it be, perhaps, that the premise of such vision is liberation from those ambitions and passions which bind us to the visible world? And does not this liberation result from the sensible fulfillment of instinctive demands, rather than from the premature or fear-born repression of them? Is it that our eyes are opened to the spirit only when the laws of the earth are obeyed? To move to the conclusion, the purpose of my commentary is to attempt to build a bridge of psychological understanding between East and West. The basis of every real understanding is man, and therefore I had to speak of human things. This must be my excuse for having dealt only with general aspects and for not having entered into technical details. Technical directions are valuable for those who know, for example, what a camera is or a combustion engine, but they are useless for anyone who has no idea of such apparatus. Western man, for whom I write, is in an analogous position. Therefore, it seems to me important, above all, to emphasize the agreement between the psychic states and the symbolisms of East and West. By means of these analogies, an entrance is opened to the inner chambers of the Eastern mind, an entrance that does not require the sacrifice of our own nature, and hence does not threaten us with being torn from our roots. If I may re-quote part of the above statement, the Western man for whom I write is in an analogous position. Possibly most people would not want to know the details of a camera or a combustion engine, for they could not use that information to control or be in charge of their lives or instinctive demands. The availability of this knowledge should be made known. Allow the individual, whether just curious or adventurous, to choose their path. I quote again, page 84, commentary by C.G. Jung. We should do well to confess at once that, fundamentally speaking, we do not understand the complete detachment from the world of a text like this. Indeed, that we do not want to understand it. Unquote. Thank you for your time.
Okay, and then who follows? Dolores follows. Very good.
My partners and I, we all had decided that to make the commentary on Jung's commentary on the Secret of the Golden Flower, we of course had to read the text, the complete text of the Golden Flower. So what I thought I would do is give my little review of the Secret of the Golden Flower and then go on to Jung's commentary. And I want to apologize, I have to read this to some extent. Lao Tzu, a sage during the Tang Dynasty around 618 AD, is accredited with the beginnings of the text of the Secret of the Golden Flower. Scholars believe that there have been other adepts who have added and changed the text during the years. The Secret of the Golden Flower is not only a Taoist text concerned with Chinese yoga, but it is also an alchemical treatise on the transformation of man or the person. The book describes the power of the light, the animus or yang soul, and the anima, the dark or yin soul force. The usual clockwise flowing of this light is a downward flowing life process in which the dual or two souls enter into relations as the intellectual and animal factors. However, and unfortunately, usually the anima, the dark soul, forces the animus or intellect to its service, whereby energies of both the souls leak away and life is consumed. The positive result is the creation of a new being in which life continues, while the original being fades away. The final and end result is death. The anima sinks, and the animus arises, and the ego is robbed of its energy and is left behind in a rather dubious state. If, on the other hand, it's been possible during life to set going the backward flowing, the rising movement of the life energies, and if the energies of the anima are mastered by the animus, then a liberation from external things takes place. The ego withdraws from its entanglements in the world and after death remains alive because interiorization has prevented the wasting of life energies in the outer world. Such a being survives as long as the inner rotation continues. It can, even though invisible, still influence men and inspire them to great thoughts and noble deeds. The saints and sages have done this. However, there remains one limitation. These beings retain a personal character and are therefore subject to the effects of space and time. Neither are they immortal any more than heaven and earth are external. The golden flower alone, which grows out of inner detachment from all entanglement with things, is eternal. A man who reaches this stage transposes his ego. He is no longer limited to the monad, but penetrates and returns to the undivided one, the Tao. In Taoism, the goal is to preserve in a transfigured form the idea of the person, the traces left by experience. That is the light which, with life, returns to itself and which is symbolized in the text by the golden flower. The golden flower is the light. One uses the golden flower as a symbol. It is the true energy of the Great One. The text goes on at great length on the practice of meditation, how one has to make the light circulate, and the golden flower is the elixir of life. And then I won't go on how the meditation is, but they in the text it says the anima, yin, is the substance of consciousness. The animus lives in the daytime, in the eyes. At night, it houses in the liver. When living in the eyes, it sees, and when houses in the liver, it dreams. And I'm going to read this paragraph on advice because I really like it. To concentrate the seed flower of the human body above in the eyes, that is the great key. Children, take heed. If for a day you do not practice meditation, this light streams out. If you only meditate for a quarter of an hour, by it you can do away with the 10,000 eons and 1,000 births. All methods end in quietness. This marvelous magic cannot be fathomed. The secret of the golden flower goes on with more details on meditation and the finding of the spiritual elixir in order to pass from death to life. The deepest secret of the alchemical bath is found in making the heart empty. While practicing contemplation of the empty, one also knows that one cannot destroy the 10,000 things. One attends to one's affairs in the midst of emptiness. The land that is nowhere, that is a true home. Out of the obscure darkness, a something develops from this nothingness. That is the golden flower of the Great One. So that is more or less what I got out of the secret of the golden flower. And then I just want to read about Jung's comment on it. It was indeed an appropriate time when Jung in 1928 received the text of the secret of the golden flower from the sinologist Richard Wilhelm. Jung had been investigating the process of the collective subconscious since 1913. This ancient Chinese text brought together for Jung the long-sought connecting link between gnosis and the process of the collective unconscious that can be observed in modern man. Previous to receiving the text from Wilhelm, Jung had noticed that some of his patients became calm and detached for no apparent reason. Jung believed this to be a new level of consciousness. The problems weren't actually solved. The patient just saw them in a different light. What on a lower level produced panicky outbursts of emotion, from the higher level of the personality, viewed the same situation in a detached way. The consciousness regarded the effect as an object. Jung began to think that everyone must have this ability to develop and possess this higher level. From his patients, he found this new thing came either outside or inside themselves. If it came from outside, it became a profound inner experience. If it came from inside, it became an outer happening, and it didn't come about by conscious willing, but rather what Jung stated is borne along on a stream of time. The patients didn't seem to do anything intentionally, but rather just let things happen. As Master Lao Tzu teaches in The Secret of the Golden Flower, letting the light circulate according to its own law, the art of letting things happen, action through non-action. This, Jung believed, was the key that opened the door to the way. The balance of the yin and yang forces or energy. The task consists solely of observing objectively how a fragment of fantasy develops. This isn't easy because the conscious mind raises innumerable objections. One has to persist in getting at one's fantasy. And Jung mentions that the hands are very helpful in creating a way of getting back to the fantasy, such as modeling, painting, drawing. And he goes on, everything good is costly, and the development of personality is the most costly. The individual must devote himself to the way with all his energy and his integrity. If we take the Tao to be the method or conscious way to unite what is separated, we have probably come as close to the psychological meaning of the concept. An alchemical method is described in The Secret of the Golden Flower, which is heating. Heating is necessary so that there is an intensification of consciousness in order that light may be kindled in the dwelling place of the true self. The union of these two produces conscious life. Jung goes on to say that the union of opposites on a higher level of consciousness is not a rational thing, nor is it a matter of will. It is a process of psychic development that expresses itself in symbols. Fantasy products become more profound and gradually concentrate in abstract structures. If the fantasies are drawn, symbols appear that are chiefly of the mandala type, which is an archaic symbol, the magic circle. Most mandalas take the form of a flower, cross, or wheel, and leads toward a quaternary structure. In The Secret of the Golden Flower, the text promises to reveal the secret. The Golden Flower is a mandala symbol, which Jung mentions was brought to him in a material form by his patients. The symbolism refers to a quasi-alchemical process of refining and ennobling. Darkness gives birth to light. Out of the lead of the water region grows the noble gold. What is unconscious becomes conscious in the form of a living process of growth. The sun wheel begins to turn. The sun is activated and begins its course. The poles of light and darkness are made to rotate. As a rule, this occurrence is spontaneous, which almost always frees the inner personality from emotional and intellectual entanglements, thus creating a unity, a liberation. Such a symbolic unity cannot be attained by the conscious will, because consciousness is always partisan. Its opponent is the collective unconscious. Therefore, it is necessary to have the magic of a symbol, which contains those primitive analogies that speak to the unconscious. The unconscious can be reached and expressed only by symbols.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Because of time, can we just go right to Sina? Thank you.
I, about 4 or 5 years ago, read this because Stephen Heller had mentioned it several times in his lectures that I was attending. And at that time, I just read it with no particular purpose, but interest for finding out what it was about. But the rereading this time, I found myself far more critical and reading it with a different response and much more aware in Jung's commentary on the limitations of Jung himself due to the time he was writing and the advancement that has occurred since in psychology with all the various testings and research that's occurred since he was writing, and of course his limitations on his own culture and background. I'm taking the phenomenon of the way and the disintegration of consciousness starts out by, in that section, by pointing out that the unconscious does have a decidedly disintegrating effect on consciousness. But the text, that is the Golden Flower, tries to mitigate this by describing the thought figures of the unconscious as empty colors and forms. Jung says that the psychologist is not to judge, but to consider the psychic effect of the unconscious, the fantasy figures also, that they can be experienced, they can be spontaneous ecstatic states or delusions or hallucinations, that the autonomous psychic contents are quite common experiences and do have a disintegrating effect upon consciousness. There are subtler, more complex emotional states, such as fragmentary psychic systems that have the character of personalities, found in mental diseases, split personalities, mediumship, and other like phenomena, and in religion, that the development in early times is from gods to personified ideas, and then to abstract ideas. He says that our true religion is a monotheism of consciousness, a possession by it, coupled with a fanatical denial of the existence of fragmentary autonomous systems. He says that our time has committed a fatal error. We believe we can criticize the facts of religion intellectually. We think God is a hypothesis that can be subjected to intellectual treatment to be affirmed or denied. Jung goes on to say that the autonomous systems are always at work, but the fundamental structure of the unconscious is not affected by the deviations of our ephemeral consciousness. He says that insanity is possession by an unconscious content that as such is not assimilated to consciousness, nor can it be assimilated since the very existence of such contents is denied. He goes on later to say, but what we have left behind are only verbal specters, not the psychic facts that were responsible for the birth of the gods. We are still as much possessed by autonomous psychic contents as if they were Olympians. Today they are called phobias, obsessions, and so forth, in a word, neurotic symptoms. The gods have become diseases. Zeus no longer rules Olympus, but rather the solar plexus, and produces curious specimens for the doctor's consulting room, or disorders the brains of politicians and journalists, who unwittingly let loose psychic epidemics in the world. And that, I think, he's quite up to date. He says that consciousness in religious terms, when a cult exists, are unreal to the extent that consciousness detaches itself from its contents. It is not a matter of indifference whether one calls something a mania or a god. To serve a mania is detestable and undignified, but to serve a god is full of meaning and promise because it is an act of submission to a higher invisible and spiritual being. The personification enables us to see the relative reality of the autonomous system and not only makes its assimilation possible, but also depotentiates the demonic forces of life. When the god is not acknowledged, egomania develops, and out of this mania comes sickness. Among the figures of the unconscious, there are gods, and there are also animus and anima. And in the main, I'm reading the selections that impressed me, not presuming to either paraphrase or interpret, but merely to comment. But he is putting together these two, at least two systems of structure of the Eastern and Western philosophy what he considers Eastern and Western, Eastern being, in this case, the Tao and the explanations in The Secret of the Golden Flower, and West, confined to his own European background, as far as I can tell. But in the text, there is the Hun, which has as its character in Chinese a sign for clouds and demon, which together in meaning is interpreted as a higher breath soul belonging to the Yang principle and therefore masculine. Then he says that the anima is, therefore he equates that with masculine and what some interpret as animus. But the anima is called the Po by Jung, which is P apostrophe O, which characters are meaning white and demon, a white ghost that belongs to the lower earthbound bodily soul, which is the yin principle and is therefore feminine. Wilhelm translates the Hun as the animus, but Jung, on the other hand, chooses to use logos for the man's spirit, because that has to him a consciousness, a clarity of consciousness and rationality. And he reserves the animus for women. The fact that the animus and anima part after death and go their ways independently shows that for the Chinese consciousness, they are distinguishable psychic factors. Originally, they were united in the one effective true human nature. But in the house of the creative, they are two. The animus is in the heavenly heart. By day, it lives in the eyes. At night, it houses in the liver. Whatever is somber and moody on waking is fettered in the anima. The logos principle is nothing personal, but is in the deepest sense impersonal, and thus in sharp contrast to the anima, which is a personal demon expressing itself in thoroughly personal moods, hence the word animosity. Feminine psychology exhibits an element that is the counterpart of a man's anima. Primarily, it is not of an affective nature, but is a quasi-intellectual factor best described by the word prejudice. The conscious side of woman corresponds to the emotional side of man, not to his mind. Mind makes up the soul, or better, the animus of woman, and just as the anima of a man consists of inferior relatedness, full of effect, so the animus of woman consists of inferior judgments, or better, opinions. As it is made up of a plurality of preconceived opinions, the animus is far less susceptible of personification by a single figure, but appears more often as a group or crowd. This is the animus in a woman. To pursue the parallel further of the East and West, yin and yang, and Hun and Po. The anima is a caricature of the feminine eros. We could say that as Hun corresponds to Sing, translated by Wilhelm as logos, so the eros of woman corresponds to Ming, fate, or destiny, interpreted by Wilhelm as eros. Eros is an interweaving, logos is differentiating knowledge, clarifying light. Eros is relatedness, logos is discrimination and detachment. Hence, the inferior logos of woman's animus appears as something quite unrelated, as an inaccessible prejudice, or as an opinion, which irritatingly enough has nothing to do with the essential nature of the object. Jung has already said, like all mental and spiritual activity in ancient times, Chinese philosophy was exclusively a component of the masculine world. Its concepts were never understood psychologically and therefore were never examined as to how